This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He is, hands down, one of the world's leading creators of documentaries. He has helped modern-day audiences understand and appreciate the Civil War, World War II, the Jazz Age, Prohibition, baseball, the Shakers, America's national parks, and so many more aspects of life in America. Well, now documentarian Ken Burns is returning to Ann Arbor, the town of his boyhood. He'll be presenting his 2012 film, The Central Park Five, at the Ann Arbor Film Festival. And he'll be talking about race and inequality as part of the Penny Stamps lecture series. Ken Burns joins us now from his home in Walpole, New Hampshire, where I guess you got about 14 inches of white stuff on the ground, Ken?
Yeah, it looks gorgeous. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Just give us a refresher to take us back to 1989. This was the widely reported attack on a woman who was jogging in Central Park, and I seem to recall the term wilding hit the news with a huge splash.
That's exactly right. On April 19th, 1989, we learned that there had been a horrific assault and rape of a woman who had been jogging in Central Park, that the police had rounded up five children who were charged with the assault, and they were apparently, according to the cops and the prosecutors, remorseless that they had confessed to this crime, that it was called wilding. It was just fun for them. The jogger was barely clinging to life. She eventually did survive and, in fact, ran the New York City Marathon 6 years later. Much a great, wonderful, happy ending to that aspect of the story. But the real story was that these five were good kids. They had not done it. Their confessions had been coerced. 14-year-old kids, 15-year-old kids, a developmentally challenged 16-year-old kid who faced upwards of 30 hours of intense police interrogation by the finest, most experienced and seasoned veterans that New York had. And they just, it was a kind of circular firing squad. We know you didn't do it, but somebody else is saying you did, and we think they did it. And if you just say you saw them do it, then, you know, we'll let you go home. And after 30 hours of no food, no parents, no lawyers, they all kind of caved. Then they recorded videotapes, which are themselves within their own confessions, filled with contradictions, and between them were filled with contradictions. And then there's not a single forensic evidence that links any of these boys to the crime scene, and it's a very bloody crime scene, and none of the crime scene on them. And there is no DNA match, and so they've got five statements, and they still don't have a missing person, and none of their statements reflected this missing person whose DNA was there. So these kids go to jail. Mm-hmm. Everybody believes confessions, upwards of 13 years, and the actual rapist, who they could have caught 2 days before this on April 17th, but forgot, and who was assaulting women all that following spring and summer and murdered a pregnant woman, was finally caught by civilians. Detectives on both cases handled it. No one thought, maybe we'll just walk the DNA from this character over to this thing.
Right.
They
had
locked it all up and tied it with a bow. And finally, one of the Central Park Five bumped into this rapist who had the sociopathic rapist murderer.
Were they in jail together, Ken?
They just bumped into each other in jail. They kept getting transferred. And so the guy confessed, and he said, look, this guy did time for something I did. And all of a sudden, 13 years later, lo and behold, it's opened up. Within a few months, new prosecutors are assigned by Robert Morgenthau, the district attorney. They decide that they will join with the defense in vacating the convictions, meaning, as Morgenthau said to many people, if we had known, then what we know now, we would have never even prosecuted these kids who were good kids, never been in the system, didn't know about Miranda, didn't know how to lawyer up, and were at the mercy of this. And the only thing was the color of their skin.
The color of their skin.
Brown and black. And that's the story. My daughter, Sarah, who is a co-director, co-writer, and co-producer with me, along with her husband, David McMahon, a filmmaker I've had the great good fortune to work with for the last 15 years. He is also a co-director, a co-producer, and I decided after Sarah wouldn't let this problem go for nearly a decade, it just obsessed her.
She wrote a book about it, didn't she?
And we had the privilege of seeing the first pages of that book come out, and we just went, oh my God, this is a film as well.
Mm.
And it's just taken off like a juggernaut. We went to Cannes Film Festival, and all of a sudden, Every festival wanted it. We had a theatrical release. The distributor thought initially it would be in a couple dozen art houses. It's been in over 110 venues. The PBS broadcast is April 16th, and really Ann Arbor, which is so perfect, is going to be one of the last theatrical opportunities for folks to see the film in the country before it's sort of pulled in anticipation of the 10 days later, a couple weeks later, the PBS broadcast on April 16th.
Now, I have to ask, and I'm going to look forward to seeing that broadcast so I can see the film, what do these former prosecutors and the detectives who you kind of said they kind of did a circular firing squad around these kids, what's the reason and how do they respond to the way things ultimately played out?
Well, in fact, they don't respond. The five launched a civil suit in 2003, 10 years ago, after their convictions had been vacated against the city, and the city has done everything they could to draw it out. The prosecutors refused to talk to us. We called the police. We called them every 6 months, said, please, you know, do this. Mm-hmm. They then, last fall, subpoenaed all of our outtakes, claiming that we had no journalistic privilege. This is the most journalistic of any film we've made. There's no narration. There's just simple title cards advancing the story where the material, the archival material and the interviews don't advance it, saying that, you know, they deserved our outtakes and all of our notes because we had produced a one-sided, biased film, when in fact they refused to comment, and we bent over backwards to find within the historical record their comments so that it could be balanced. So the reason why they didn't give us any interviews is they couldn't answer any of the questions that we would have asked them, and they continue to hold on to the fact that they got the right guys, even though there's no DNA evidence, and the real guy went off to murder and rape other people, and that these kids therefore must have run with this guy. This is a sociopath who worked alone. These kids, you know, barely knew each other. Only two of them knew each other. The rest, it was just, you know, kids from the same project area and the edge of Harlem and Spanish Harlem in New York, and they were all good kids. They had no record, no nothing, and it's just one of these travesties, and they couldn't admit a mistake, and they were willing to sacrifice five black and brown kids for their mistake.
And of the Central Park Five, they certainly lost their childhood. They were children, really, when you say 15, 16 years old.
Oh.
What of them today?
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. They're extraordinary human beings who we've had the great privilege of getting to know. You know, in 1989, being a member of the Central Park Five meant among the lowest people ever in humanity. I mean, it was called the crime of the century. It was not just a news story in New York. It was around the world that lost control of our cities.
Yeah.
And that it fit into this old narrative that Americans, you know, you thought we'd gotten over at the end of the, you know, 20th century in a progressive northern city, that a white woman and black beasts, you know, this is, you know, birth of a nation, gone with the wind kind of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just being perpetrated as if it was Jim Crow South in the, you know, 1910 or 1890. Really bad, bad, bad lynch mentality. Donald Trump bought full-page ads asking for the restoration of the death penalty. The commentator Patrick Buchanan said that the oldest of them, this is the developmentally challenged Corey Wise, should be taken out into Central Park and hung, and the others flogged. It did eventually, the outcry from this did eventually help persuade legislators to restore the death penalty in New York State, which had been out since the Supreme Court decision in the 70s. So it was a, you know, a dark, dark day for New York, and the kids suffered. They had the guts taken out of their childhood, and they went to prison, and everything you worry about, fantasize, hear about in prison happened. And they've got varying degrees of PTSD, all of them. One of them, we couldn't even film on camera. He had exiled himself to the South, changed his name, works as a forklift operator, keeps his head down, pays his taxes, you know, hugs his kid every night, and still, I'm sure, worries that somewhere some big hand is going to come on his shoulder. And so you just hear his voice, and we have the pictures of him from the time.
Mm.
And the other four are still in New York with varying degrees of success and management of their issues. Corey Wise, the developmentally challenged one, the oldest, who's 40, has the most difficult time because of his disability. And a couple are doing quite well. And we're out with almost all four of them all the time at screenings for schools and at theaters and, you know, various places. And they remind you that if they were once the worst human beings on earth, they're now among the most admirable, with a great forbearance, a lack of bitterness, surprising lack of bitterness, and a sense that they're not going to be defeated by the city's stall tactics, that they're just going to sit there. They need resolution. But you know what? So do those detectives and those prosecutors. So does the city. So do all of us, that we could have so easily, the media, so easily bought into this story for its sensationalism and not, you know, when they were exonerated, not made that a big story. And there's still people who say they're guilty of sin. And it's a sad, sad day.
I would say the exoneration certainly was way under the media radar.
You know, it was A1, as you know, on all the tabloids, all the newspapers,
yes,
leading the news for weeks and weeks and weeks in New York and even around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vacation of the convictions was page D23.
Isn't that something?
And, you know, a kind of an interesting phenomenon is that when you sort of make these informal surveys, you know, 100% of people have heard of the case if they were old enough. 90% are unaware that they were exonerated. Of the 10% that do, most of those think they got off on a technicality. So here you have these innocent kids that, you know, but for the grace of God and the color of their skin, would not be in the predicament they're in, end up in this hell, you know, 13 years of justice denied and then another 10 years of justice delayed, which we know is also justice denied. It appealed to us, you know. It appealed to us because it's so outrageous that it could still be happening in this country.
I'm speaking with documentarian Ken Burns, who will be bringing his 2012 film, The Central Park Five, to the Ann Arbor Film Festival this Saturday. And people are looking forward to that. And you're coming back to where you grew up.
I am coming tomorrow. I'm so excited. It's been a few years since I've been back. I've tried to get back every year, and it's not always possible. And I can't begin to tell you how formative Ann Arbor was for me in so many ways. I'm a filmmaker because I grew up in Ann Arbor. I am, you know, who I am formed there. I love the town. I'm very excited. My parents are buried there, so it's a way to come back and connect.
Why are you a filmmaker and documentarian? You bring such insight and certainly this this sense of race and inequality that infuses itself into most every piece that you do.
Yeah, and we don't go looking for race. You know, I think it's just present. If you're interested in a serious study of America and its history, you inevitably bump into race. It's there in our conception when Thomas Jefferson says all men are created equal, but oops, he happens to own other people and he doesn't see the contradiction.
Right, right.
So we're always sort of having to confront it. This is what our country's work is, if you will. So I grew up in Ann Arbor in the civil rights era and watching all of that stuff in the Vietnam era. My mother was very, very mortally sick with cancer the whole time, and she died. And I remember my dad and always let me stay up late. He had a pretty strict curfew, but let me stay up late to watch movies and to go to the Cinema Guild and the campus theater for foreign films. And it was wonderful to sort of not only bond with him, but I watched him cry. When I was 12 years old, in the year after my mom died, I watched him cry and understand I'd never seen him cry before.
Mm.
And that this powerful medium had the ability to protect as well as unlock emotions. That if he hadn't cried at my mom's funeral, he had cried at this. And that was a way that he could express himself. And right then and there, at age 12, I said, I want to be a filmmaker.
In fact, I'd like to find out, Ken, what would you say to those young people who seem to always have a video camera handy and look at your work and say, I want to do that?
I have pretty probably frustrating advice. I mean, the biggest thing is that the proliferation of cameras and the ease in which we can express ourselves with those cameras, that is to say the Internet, is a good thing for the most part, but it doesn't make you a storyteller. And a storyteller involves really rigorous and desperately long hours. So the advice I have is to sort of, you know, be Socratic, you know yourself, that you have something to say and that you know what you want to do, the way you want to express it, and to persevere. There's no other way. I mean, it is not enough to have a camera and a computer. It requires a great deal of work. And while our job is to spend time making the films look effortless so that you can look at them and go, wow, I could do that. When you make a film, it should look seamless, but people what they don't see, and nor should they see, unless you're contemplating that career or that professional life, is that it may have taken us 7 years of hard work day after day to get a story polished, to find the archives, to tell it, to use the right music, the right commentary, or the right writing, all of the different things that go in, the millions and millions of elements. And that's what's not seen.
You had mentioned you're working on Vietnam is upcoming, and I also note on the IMDb you're revisiting Jack Johnson.
Yeah, we are. Well, right now that's just a pie in the sky idea with HBO to do a dramatic series on my two-part 2005 documentary on the life of the first African American heavyweight champion Jack Johnson. But the pipeline right now is we've just finished a massive series on Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. That I think is the best thing we've done. We're, of course, releasing Central Park 5 next month. After that's the Roosevelts. We're doing a film on dyslexic kids who memorize the Gettysburg Address. We're doing a biography of Jackie Robinson, who is a central part of our baseball series but deserves special standalone treatment. The Vietnam thing, which is just about to go into the editing room. And we're researching a big history called a big multi-part series, 14, 15 hours, called I Can't Stop Loving You, A History of Country Music.
Oh, can't wait.
I mean, I feel like I have the best job in the country. It educates all my parts, but mainly you get to do deep, deep dives, thanks to public television, without commercial interruption, thanks to public television. And at times reach 30 or 40 million of our fellow citizens with complicated and not just sugar-coated or superficial stories. And, you know, that's a good thing.
Ken Burns will be presenting the Central Park Five at the Ann Arbor Film Festival on Saturday at noon. You can get all the details at aafilmfest.org. And then come April 16th, the film will premiere on PBS. Ken Burns, a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us.
It's my pleasure. I can't wait to get back to